Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. The time is now 1:01 p.m. on Wednesday, March 18th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. The following members are present: Representative Eichheit, Representative Vance, Representative Costello, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to recognize the staff supporting this meeting: Sophia Tenney from House Records, Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have three items of business on today's agenda: HJR 43, voter privacy; HJR 31, constitutional amendment, corporations and rights; HJR 41, rescind request for constitutional convention. I would note for the record that we were joined by Representative Mina at 1:01 p.m. Our first item of business is HJR 43, relating to voter privacy, sponsored by the House Judiciary Committee. This is our second hearing on the resolution. We have the House Majority Staff and Counsel Sean Mills in the room to answer questions. My intent today is to take a public testimony first, and then we will have an opportunity for brief questions or comments from the committee. In the interest of time, we are not going to be hearing from the Department of Administration today. I am going to ask if members have questions for the department regarding real ID, tribal identification, or other related issues, to provide the questions in writing to my committee aide so that he can work to have the correct people available to answer those questions. We were joined at 1:02 p.m. by Representative Zach Fields. We will now open the floor for public testimony on HJR 43. If there's anyone in the room who would like to testify on HJR 43, seeing no one in the room, we'll move online. Seeing no one online, we will close. Oh, sorry. We have someone. Thank you. We will go to Mike Coons in Wasilla. If you can take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Yeah, this is Mike Coons, and I oppose HJR 43. What the DOJ has done is with all states. They have requested voter information so that no illegal aliens, dead people, or other unauthorized citizens can vote in a federal election. Does this impact those who may have registered to vote in Alaska local and state elections? Of course it does. This is a plus for our election integrity as well. As to page 4, lines 12 through 25, further resolved. Subparagraph 1. The use of Alaska Natives as a reason is laughable, to say the least. How many illegal aliens live in Alaska villages? Those illegals will stand out like a sore thumb, not to mention birth certificates are not maintained in villages, but rather the State Department of Health and or vital statistics. Subparagraph 2. Those in rural areas all have mail. They can use the post office to request a birth certificate or other documents, thus no real unique challenges. Subparagraph 3. The number of Alaskan Natives born before modern records is laughably low. Subparagraph 4. And this is just plain silly. As a retired United States Air Force NCO who was born in Oregon, I voted without any problems for those 20 years. In fact, as a vet, I take grave offense at inferring that we are too dumb to get needed information, documents to vote, be those birth certificates, marriage certificates, or requesting an absentee ballot. Subparagraph 5. Again, you're saying to people that have spent a lot of time becoming a naturalized citizen that they're just too dumb to show proper documents to register to vote. And subparagraph 6. If there is a challenge of a voter as to if they are a citizen, or they're not a felon, or they're not voting in two other states, or they're not dead, or whatever, you want to protect, then that means that you want to protect people whom are possibly committing voter fraud. Actually, that isn't a question, since it is exactly what this resolution does and what the Democrat, Socialist, Marxist, Communist Party wants to do to begin with. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no further testifiers, we are closing testimony on HJR 43. We will now set HJR. Oh, I would now like to set an amendment deadline on HJR 43 for Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We were joined by Representative Kopp at 1:06 p.m. At ease. Can we turn that off? I'll just restate that an amendment deadline for HJR 43 has been set for Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. At ease. I'm sorry. Back on the record, our next item of business is HJR 31, Constitutional Amendment, Corporations and Rights, sponsored by Representative Fields. At this time, I would like to invite Representative Fields and staff Michael Naughty to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Gray, Zach Fields, House District 17, and I was wondering maybe we can queue up the PowerPoint here.
At ease. Back on the record, we were joined by Representative Jubilee Underwood at 1:07 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach Fields, House District 17. House Joint Resolution 31 is a proposed constitutional amendment clarifying that persons in the state constitution refers to natural persons, i.e. living, breathing people, not corporations. And in short, when our constitution was written, it was broadly understood that persons are, in fact, human beings. Since then, many judicial decisions that I would characterize as judicial activism have redefined person to include a corporation. So in my view, HJR 31 would return the definition of person in our Constitution to the original purpose of what a person is. Why does that – is this an abstract issue or does it matter? I would argue that it matters because – Alaskans have voted, and the legislature has established campaign contribution limits to protect a functioning democracy on multiple occasions over many years. I think most Alaskans broadly support campaign contributions. When you look at the campaign contributions, they were very reasonable. And yet the court has struck down these prohibitions based on the judicial activism that redefined a person who's a human to a person that includes a corporation. Brief history of some of that judicial activism. Buckley v. Valeo, which was a U.S. Supreme Court case, 1976, said that political money and financial contributions are equal to speech. If you accept the premise of that case, then corporations have more rights than individual people, proportional to the amount of money they have. I think that's obviously inconsistent with the Constitution, both state and federal. Citizens United sort of took this argument to the extreme, unfettered spending as a component of speech. And in Alaska, the case Thompson v. Hebden, Hebden is with is an employee of AIPOC, so representing AIPOC, struck down Alaska's limits on campaign contributions. So if you are curious about the logic of persons constituting humans and not a corporation, there's a lot of rich judicial history. I have some quotes here from, yes.
At ease. Back on the record and heading over back to, so sorry for the interruption, Representative Fields, we have resolved our echoes and white noise issue.
Thank you again, Zach Fields, House District 17. I again appreciate the opportunity to be here. I think there's a very compelling case that humans are persons. Justice Stevens here from 2010 dissenting in the Citizens United case is a particularly strong statement. So again, what are the practical impacts of equating corporate money with human speech? Massive state spending. I would argue it's toxic for a functioning democracy. Of course, we've seen some of this spending in the state of Alaska. The funny thing about it is you never know when it's going to hit your race, but I don't think there's any question that it's bad for democracy. The growth in contributions is crazy. Here we have well over $1 billion in dark money groups. So it's sort of funny to say that a corporation has freedom of speech, but they can cloak it in dark money. That doesn't really make sense to me when you think about this record of judicial activism. Corporate personhood directly relates or directly causes more money in politics. This is the source of contributions. It's dominated by massive companies, not individuals, not community or other type of groups of individual people. Defining money as speech and corporations as people has led to a tsunami of spending by billionaires trying to manipulate the law to help themselves at the expense of everyone else. The numbers are unambiguous. In closing, I don't think there's any question that judicial activism redefining corporation or redefining person to include corporations has driven a massive and toxic increase in corporate spending. And unfortunately, there's no way the Alaska founders could have foreseen this when they put our constitution together in 1957. This proposed constitutional amendment would restore the original intent of our state constitution, frankly, to mirror the original intent of the U.S. Constitution and define persons as people. And this idea is from my constituent and former representative, Harriet Drummond. So I just wanted to thank Representative Drummond for asking me to introduce this HJR, which I think is a good idea.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Fields, for bringing this forward. This is highly intriguing, especially when you're talking about natural persons. I could just see our former representative, Jesse Sumner, perking up because he had a lot of concerns about the future of AI and what we would see. I find it interesting that a lot of the conversation is around campaign finance. and was wondering why you feel, I understand, you know, natural persons and corporation, but why are you compelled to add campaign finance to our constitution? Usually our constitution is like the framework and then everything else we fill in statute. Why has this reached the level to be added to the constitution?
Could I take a brief at ease, please?
Yes, at ease.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Vance. Yeah, I mainly cited the corporate spending as a an impact of redefining person that can be easily documented. And because this judicial activism had changed Alaska law counter to the will of voters, that's why it is written that way. However, if you think it makes more sense for this HJR to be more foundational and simply have sections 1 and 2, I would support that, assuming that Ledge Legal would confirm with us that would reestablish the legislature and voters' ability to promulgate campaign finance regulations should they wish. I don't think that the campaign finance provisions necessarily need to be in the Constitution. The key here is to define natural persons, which could be a more limited version of the HJR that is before you right now.
Follow up? Well, that was going to be my second question, is if you have any insight if this would be considered a revision versus amending the Constitution. That's always the big question, is how far can we push the envelope before it would then open up the Constitution? And this this one seems more extensive, and I was wondering what reasons you had in being that thorough. I appreciate thoroughness, but again, Have you received any insight if this, what direction this may go?
Through the chair, I don't think Ledge Legal has raised that concern. Is it written so broad that it would sort of reopen the entire Constitution? I don't want to do that. I think the purpose of this HJR is actually just to reinforce the original definition of person under the Alaska Constitution. And again, if the committee wanted to narrow it to just sections 1 and 2, frankly, I'm fine with that. I think we could, you know, through statute or citizen ballot initiative, discuss campaign finance limits. So, your call.
Thank you. I will ask legal what they think about the scope of this. And another question that was raised is if anything would run afoul with our U.S. Constitution, with corporations. But I really like standing on state sovereignty.
Thank you. I'll just say that my committee aide did request a legal memo. We have it. We would need to talk to the drafter of the memo, because I'll just read a little bit from the memo, if that's okay. The question was, does HJR 31 raise First Amendment issues given Citizens United? And the memo says the short answer is yes. The prohibition raises a First Amendment issue. Political campaign contributions and expenditures fall within the protections of the First Amendment. What is less clear is how a court might address the issue. And that's when it goes into detail about how, in some ways, by saying that the First Amendment only applies to natural persons, we're basically going before Citizens United. And Montana apparently tried to do it, and Montana. So there's lots and lots of details in the memo about Montana and about what the answers were. What's my pause is because they talk specifically, the memo talks specifically about how allowing for corporations that specifically are designed to influence elections in some ways it makes it more palatable. But maybe the lawyer would say, no, actually just including sections 1 and 2 would stand up. I shouldn't say they never said it stands up. It says they're novel questions that have not been addressed. Representative Fields.
And thanks through the chair, Zach Fields, House District 17. I would say bring it on. Let's take it to court and litigate the yes, we believe natural persons are humans under the Alaska Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. I mean, let's face it, we're in a period of unprecedented judicial activism. The Supreme Court has become the third legislative body in D.C. I think they have no shred of credibility, frankly, the way they're aggressively redefining laws. And who knows, by the time that this got passed and litigated, there might be a new Supreme Court that would return to a more originalist interpretation of humans as natural persons, and that perhaps we could be a facilitator of that return to a more honest interpretation of the Constitution. And that would be a very positive contribution to the honoring the original intent of the U.S. Constitution.
I want to pause questions and go ahead and let Mr. Naughty go ahead and walk us through the sectional analysis.
Thank you. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Michael Naughty. I will be going through the sectional analysis for HJR 31. Section 1. This section amends Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska to modify persons to be natural persons. Section 2. This section amends Article 1 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska by adding a new section titled Section 26, Rights Belong to Natural People. Section 3. This section amends Article 12 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska by adding a new section titled Section 15, Contributions and Expenditures Made to Influence an Election. Section 4. This section amends Article 15 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska by adding two new sections titled Section 30, Applicability of Amendments Providing for Rights and Limiting Contributions and Expenditures Made to Influence an Election, and Section 31, Implementation of Amendment Limiting Contributions and Expenditures Made to Influence an Election. Section 5. This section states that amendments proposed by this resolution shall be placed before the voters of the state at the next general election in accordance with applicable laws. This concludes the sectional analysis. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Costello?
So you had mentioned dark money and the influence of dark money. Do you have a definition, or could you explain what you mean by dark money?
Yes, Zach Fields, House District 17. Through the chair, dark money is political expenditures where the source of that money is not disclosed to voters.
So is the 907 initiative or Alaskans for Posterity or independent expenditures considered dark money sources?
Through the chair, I don't recall offhand the extent to which they disclose their donors. So it's kind of interesting because Alaska actually has better disclosure laws than at the federal level. I would say those disclosure laws, as I recall, require the top three donors, but some of the other donors are not named. So I would have to go look at those groups and see, are they fully disclosing their donors?
Two follow-ups.
Oh, permission to dialogue granted.
So when we talk about influencing an election, it's my understanding that a mailer could not suggest that you vote against something or someone, but just bash the person. So I'm that phrase influencing an election, I think would be interesting to delve deeper into that. And then my second question is about on page 2 under section 15 or section 3 of the bill. So how does this impact out-of-state donors? I mean, we're talking about the Alaska Constitution and natural, you're placing the word natural in front of the word person. Would it then apply to an out-of-state individual and therefore an out-of-state donor?
Through the chair, great points and questions. I agree with them. To your first point, and I'll return to that. In my view, we should have the strongest possible constitutional framework to empower the legislature and voters through initiative or legislation, frankly, to put whatever restrictions or disclosure requirements on outside political spending that we want. So if it's legislators and voters' will that, a political ad paid for by outside donors be prohibited at a certain level, I think we should be able to do that. If, we as a legislature and a populace want to say, there aren't outside campaign contributions to the state of Alaska, I think that should be our decision to make. I think state sovereignty should trump the attempted influence peddling by these outside groups. To your first point, you accurately note that influencing elections sometimes does not occur in as simple a way as vote for or against so-and-so. It's, oh, tell so-and-so they were bad for voting for this or that bill, right? It's arguably not directly influencing an election, but somehow the money happens to come in competitive districts during periods of election, right? I would love to restrict that.
No further questions.
We have invited testimony. Are there any other questions before we hear from invited testimony?
Let's go ahead. Let's hear from them.
Okay. I will now call on Kevin Morford, President of Alaska Move to Amend. Mr. Morford, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Kopp, and honorable members of the committee. My name is Kevin Morford, and I am the president of Alaska Move to Amend. We are an Anchorage-based, all-volunteer, nonprofit organization that has been working to abolish corporate constitutional rights with an amendment to the United States Constitution since at least 2015. Our organization strongly supports passage of HJR 31, both with respect to the campaign expenditure issue and with respect to the abolition of state constitutional rights for corporations and other artificial entities. But in my testimony, I will focus on the constitutional rights issue only. What is the relationship between a national constitutional amendment abolishing corporate constitutional rights and HJR 31? The legal effect of HJR 31 will not be to abolish federal constitutional rights for corporations. Under the Supremacy Clause, a state cannot do that. Under HJR 31, only state constitutional rights of corporations would be eliminated. Currently, corporations in Alaska are protected by two sets of constitutional rights, those which are granted to them under the U.S. Constitution and those which are granted under the Alaska Constitution. The Alaska Supreme Court has held that rights under the Alaska Constitution can be even stronger than the rights under the U.S. Constitution. HJR 31 would clearly establish that the Alaska Constitution does not provide any additional constitutional rights for corporations beyond those which are granted under the U.S. Constitution. And if and when corporate constitutional rights are abolished under the U.S. Constitution, the Alaska Constitution would not then remain as an additional source of constitutional rights for corporations. Why shouldn't corporations have any constitutional rights? The judicially created doctrine that corporations are persons who have constitutional rights has been a major factor in thwarting policies that are favored by the actual human beings who live in this country. This doctrine has been used by corporations to greatly restrict our ability to enact beneficial laws in this country. There are many different reasons why this doctrine is nonsensical, but let me just list four of those reasons for the committee. First, corporations and other artificial entities are created by humans as tools that can allow us to achieve goals that we want to accomplish. But corporations are not endowed by their creators with inalienable rights. They should only have the abilities and protections that we decide to give them. There are activities that corporations need to be able to carry out and some protections that they need, but these things can easily be dealt with by statute and do not need to be enshrined in our Constitution. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has declared that corporations have constitutional rights that cannot be infringed upon even by legislatures. The result is the nonsensical situation where a state can create corporations, but then is powerless to limit or shape the court-created constitutional rights of those corporations. This doctrine infringes upon your powers as legislators. The second reason is that corporations have many powers and abilities and protections that are not possessed by human beings. They can continue to exist forever and are not susceptible to disease or infirmity. They can raise money by selling shares of ownership of themselves. They can never be in prison for violating the law. They cannot experience pain and do not suffer from the adverse consequences of their economic activities, such as pollution or blight. Because of these types of fundamental differences from actual humans, they behave very differently from the ways that most humans behave. Some psychologists have diagnosed corporations as sociopaths because they are only concerned with maximizing their own profits and do not have any remorse about whom they hurt as they pursue their goals. It is ridiculous that an unelected body, the U.S. Supreme Court, has decided to grant constitutional rights to such entities. The third reason is that by enshrining corporate protections as constitutional rights, the courts have made it extremely difficult for those rights to be adjusted over time, as experience may suggest is prudent. If the courts had recognized that the protections for corporations were properly addressed by the legislatures instead of by the courts, then those protections and powers could have been adjusted as appropriate to the times and circumstances. By eliminating constitutional protections for corporations, it will be much easier to adjust their limits and protections with statutory changes. The final reason I will mention here is because there is no textual basis and no original intent basis for this grant of constitutional rights to corporations in either the United States Constitution or in the Alaska Constitution. A little diversion into constitutionalist history is necessary to explain this point. When the Bill of Rights was originally acted in the U.S. Constitution, there were no limitations placed upon the states by that document. The Bill of Rights limited what the federal government can do, but not what the states could do. If a state government wanted to infringe on the free speech of its citizens, it was free to do that under the Bill of Rights. A state might have been limited under its own constitution, but that was not based upon the Bill of Rights. This remained the law until the adoption of the 14th Amendment following the Civil War. The original intent for the 14th Amendment was to provide protections for the freed slaves against violations of their civil rights by federal, state, and local governments. But because the Bill of Rights had only applied to the federal government up until that time, it was necessary to include a constitutional provision that made the civil rights protections also applicable to the states also. That is one of the most fundamental changes that was made by the 14th Amendment. For the first time, the civil rights set out in the Bill of Rights placed limits upon what actions could be taken by state and local governments. But it was left to the courts to flesh out the details of what limitations had or had not been placed on the states by the 14th Amendment. Over time, the courts have issued a series of decisions in which various protections that are spelled out in the Bill of Rights have been incorporated into the 14th Amendment. These include such protections as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of peaceable assembly, due process, and equal protection. There are, of course, others. After the 14th Amendment was passed, corporations started trying to get the courts to hold that they were also protected against adverse government actions, just like the freed slaves were protected. The 14th Amendment did not even mention corporations at all. So the corporations argued to the courts that the phrase, quote, any person, unquote, as used in the 14th Amendment, included corporations, even though the preceding language clearly showed that the amendment was talking about actual humans and not artificial entities. In 1886, the Supreme Court bought into this argument and started holding that corporations did have constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment. And over time, since then, states have also started to recognize corporate constitutional rights under their own state constitutions. Many people believe that this doctrine of corporate constitutional rights is an egregious error and contrary to the plain text and original intent of the adopters of the 14th Amendment, which was enacted to protect formerly enslaved persons. The bottom line is that there is nothing in the U.S. Constitution and nothing in the Alaska Constitution that expressly mentions corporations as being protected by constitutional rights. This is entirely an invention of the judiciary with no textual basis and no original intent basis. Based upon these considerations, Alaska Move to Amend strongly supports passage of H.J.R. 31 so that the Alaska Constitution will no longer be a source of constitutional protections for corporations and other artificial entities. I encourage the members of this committee to pass H.J.R. 31 out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for taking up this important resolution. I'll be happy to try and respond to any questions you may have.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Representative Kopp.
Yes, thank you, sir, for your testimony. So you've been advocating for this, sounds like, since 2015, I believe you said. Is this correct?
I'm sorry. I'm having a difficult time hearing you, Vice Chair Kopp.
Sure. Yeah. Sorry. I'll speak closer to the mic. You've been advocating for this constitutional amendment or something like it since 2015. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, we've been advocating at the national level.
Okay.
We are part of a national organization. We're the local affiliate of the national organization.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. So have you ever run into a situation where maybe there was an unintended consequence that affected the constitutional or a statutory right of association of a nonprofit organization? Maybe it would be a labor organization, any business entity outside this focus area, which is the context of influencing elections. I'm just concerned about any unintended consequence, preserving intent of the bill, but avoiding a sweeping unintended consequence where those entities could get drawn up into it. Have you seen that or seen any litigation associated with that?
Certainly, unintended consequences are a very important consideration when looking at proposed changes to the law, whether constitutional or statutory. Our organization has looked at those issues very carefully. Our contention is that by shifting protections for corporations and other artificial entities into a statutory framework instead of having them stuck in a constitutional framework, there is greater flexibility to make adjustments over time so that any unintended consequences can be addressed by future statutory changes.
Okay. So I guess just to be perfectly clear, I'm thinking of how do we narrowly confine, because I believe the purpose is about campaign finance and election-related activity. I'm looking at the bill sponsor. I think that's what we're talking about. Campaign finance and elected-related activity and the rights protected in that sense under the Constitution are reserved to natural persons.
Through the chair there, I guess as the HJR is written right now, that is one purpose. But there's also this other purpose of just clarifying persons or natural persons and not corporations. So as written, it does do those two things. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually fine if the committee wants to narrow it to just defining natural persons and sort of leave to the legislature and to voters how they address campaign finance. I don't have a strong opinion about that.
I was just thinking, maybe I'm thinking more about statutory law than constitutional law, Representative Fields. And I just went to possibly needing a qualifier that would say something like nothing in this section shall be construed, to limit the constitutional or statutory rights of those entities, those associations, those labor organizations, those nonprofits. And that way everybody knows we're talking about election related activity.
Right.
And anyway, just thought. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the liberty there.
Thanks. Mr. Morford, are you an attorney?
I'm retired. I practiced law in Alaska for 23 years, but I'm retired now.
Well, you have a lot more authority than I do, but I am not an attorney. But I am going to read from my legal memo because it disagrees with you. It says that basically if we pass this, that we really don't have Citizens United in Alaska anymore. I'll just read from the legal memo. Citizens United addressed whether campaign finance laws could apply to corporations that already possessed political spending power under state law. Citizens United did not require states to grant corporations political spending power. No Supreme Court case has ever held that states must do so. Long-standing doctrine recognizes that states control the powers of the artificial entities they create. To strike down that doctrine, a court would have to say that corporations possess a constitutional entitlement to political spending power that exists independently of state law. No court has ever said that. This is not an attempt to get around the Constitution. It is an effort to operate squarely within existing constitutional doctrine. Nothing in the U.S. Constitution requires states to create corporations with political spending authority, and no Supreme Court president has ever held otherwise. All of these quotes are coming from Montana because they did this. And so I don't know. It's pretty firm that I think it gives a lot of weight behind us doing this because if Citizens United was about state created, you know, the state law saying that these corporations had political spending power. So if we say that corporations don't have it, then Citizens United doesn't apply.
That's the way I think that the law should work. I'm not convinced that the federal courts would rule that way if squarely presented with that question. My understanding is that Citizens United, and I have read it on a couple of occasions, Citizens United was based upon the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and my understanding is that it held that corporations, especially under Buckley v. Vallejo, which was an earlier court decision, that corporations do have First Amendment rights, and it was based upon those First Amendment rights of the corporations that the ruling was being made. I would welcome a decision by the federal courts that was consistent with the memo you just read. I'm not convinced that they would rule that way currently.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I did want to follow up on a comment of Representative Kopp, which I think is a good line of inquiry, which is essentially don't write this in such a way that you quash the individual speech rights of Alaskans. So in my view, if this passed, you know, would the Alaska Chamber of Commerce be able to continue to have a political action committee? Well, absolutely. And individuals could contribute to that. CEOs, rank and file workers, whomever, labor unions could continue to have PACs. They're funded by individual labor union members. Those are individual people making a contribution. If it was narrowed to Representative Vance's proposal of just defining natural persons, the legislature would have the ability to say, hey, we are limiting, say, corporate contributions or having disclosure requirements or outlawing them potentially. But individuals' rights to weigh in would be preserved, whether an individual making a contribution or an individual making a contribution through a PAC. All those rights would be preserved, would be my reading under this HJR. And those individual rights should be preserved.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. What about your freedom of speech when you are required to join a union because of your job, and then your dues are used to influence an election? I mean, to me, that seems like your freedom of speech has been either curtailed or kind of hijacked. I mean, I know this probably doesn't delve into that issue, but it brings that to mind to me, because a PAC is different than what you're calling a labor organization or a union when you are required to pay the union to negotiate your contracts and what have you, and yet then that money might be diverted without your explicit approval.
Well, through the chair, so to my knowledge, unions in Alaska express their political input through PACs, and all those PACs are voluntary contributions from members. It's a per hour voluntary contribution, and union members have to affirmatively say, yes, I want to do this. In addition to that, members of any labor union, and this under federal law, can say, I am only paying dues for representation purposes, which is to say for bargaining and for grievances, and that restricts their dues from being used for anything else. Even something as simple as a union member's kid broke their leg and you have a contribution fund, can't use it for that. Definitely can't use it for politics. So I think existing law and practice already protect individuals' free choice to either participate or not participate in their union's PACs. Could I mention one more thing?
Yes.
I don't want this HJR to be read as anti-corporate. You know, Alaska has some large corporations that do fantastic work. And I think it's a tragic irony that the politicization of corporate speech has actually caused a significant degradation in public confidence in corporations. And I would direct members' attention to a recent survey conducted by the Pew Trust that found 71% of Americans have a negative perception of large corporations. I mean, that is unbelievable, 71%. So when I think about, is it in America's interest to have a strong Ford Motor Company or ConocoPhillips or ASRC or pick these companies? Like, yeah, we want healthy American companies, including large companies. And I think one reality we've seen since 2010 is, unfortunately, politicizing this corporate speech actually undermines public support in capitalism itself. So I hope the members see this HJR as being supportive of business, because I think we should want those companies to succeed, which is very different than them feeling obligated to weigh in politics. And I would note, in this Pew study, support for large corporations has declined precipitously as campaign finance laws have been repealed. So I would say let's go back to the days when, you know, like Alfred Sloan said, what's good for GM is good for America and vice versa. That can be true, I think, when we depoliticize these corporate contributions.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the dialogue, because this is – our Constitution impacts so many other areas. But I feel like this is going in the area of you know, our rights of association as well, not just free speech. But does this amendment propose that an individual's, a natural person's freedom of speech would be limited when they choose to associate under a corporation?
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, no, because those individuals can continue to participate in politics and contribute their personal money and so on.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Permission to dialogue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The questions that you raised, Vice Chair Kopp, of, you know, we're seeing corporations, but that also would, because it's a constitution, it would impact all of these other groups of people, or could impact these groups of people. And I think that is something that we need to consider in this sweep is would we be limiting other entities, other groups of people, whether they're incorporated or not, from exercising their free speech? And it has very broad implications. And besides the first part regarding natural persons, I think that's going to have much broader implications than just than elections. I'm thinking about the artificial intelligence. That's why I think it's very intriguing. I feel like at least that section defining natural persons should be a direction that we should go. But what does autonomy mean in this question? And I think those are things that we need to dive into. I understand the intent is specific to you're wanting a certain objective, but when it comes to our Constitution, we can't anticipate what the impact would be in 50 years. And that's what we're being asked to do right now, is if we're going to change our Constitution, is it still going to be just as true and valid 50 and 100 years from now? And so I would like to pursue every possible negative impact that we can think of right now, because I don't want to limit people's right to associate with their money in the way that they see fit. And I think that's something that we should pursue. I'm not asking any direct question right now. I'm just saying these are some of the thoughts that come to mind on the very big impacts, but do understand the concern that is being raised. While I disagree with some of the comments about our Supreme Court, but I think this has been the long struggle, is where are those limitations when it's not just speech, but it's association that's involved as well.
Thank you. I'm going to say something and then we'll go to Representative Field and then Representative Kopp. So I think we should try to do it right. and do the best we can, but I don't think we should be limited by what it might look like in 50 or 100 years. Those Alaskans can amend their constitution at that time if needed. Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I think, again, there are sort of two things in this HR. One is campaign finance. Arguably, that's more complicated. One is, what is the original constitutional intent of persons? And I think all this does is just maintain fidelity with the original purpose of our constitution, which is to say persons are natural persons. So that in no way would limit freedom of association and so on. So I think if your interest is in narrowing it and only having sections 1 and 2, you're pretty much problem solved. And again, I'm fine with that if that's where the committee wants to go.
Representative Kopp.
Yes. Mr. Chairman. So yeah, I mean, philosophically, I totally support what the bill sponsor is trying to do with the defining it as natural persons. It's clear that as we've come along after 250 years, what was plain on the face, we're talking about human beings. Now we have avatars and, right, you know, all these other things. And, you know, and it's maybe not so obvious anymore that we need to say we're actually talking about, you know, people who come into this world through the natural human conception, selection, birth process. And that's what we're talking about. And that's the simple legal term. So I only mentioned the issue I did was just to think about, and I think we've kind of resolved it if we focus on the first two sections, that we are, nothing in this would affect the constitutional or statutory rights of association for those entities. So that, yes, labor organizations, Representative Fields is exactly right. I can speak from experience. The Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, their political action committee is a separate committee that you have to donate to. You're not forced to, nor can you be required to donate to that. It's the same thing with the troopers and you know, so I know our labor organizations do operate that way. But as long as we're clear on what we're doing here, I don't see an inadvertent consequence for labor or trade associations. Maybe it's Resource Development Council or the Alliance or anybody to be able to engage in advocacy through their donations of their members.
Thank you. We will now open public testimony on HDR 31. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one, we'll go online. We'll start with Mike Coons in Wasilla. If you will take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, how many minutes do I have?
You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself against this socialist, Marxist, communist attempt at suppressing free speech and association. Thanks to Senator Representative Vance on that. One of the most glaring parts of this attempt is Section 15, quote, except for a group organized under state law for the principal purpose of influencing the outcome of one or more elections, end quote. Are these most likely NGOs and socialist, Marxist, communist groups? And that section goes on to say, quote, a corporation, limited liability company, or other artificial person, no definition of what an artificial person is, may not make a contribution or expenditure to influence a state or local election, end quote. Yet, quote, the freedom of the press may not be abridged under this section, end quote. Which press? Alaska Beacon, ADN, other socialist media, all of which are corporations with the express purpose of influencing voters to oppose conservative thought and promote socialist, Marxist, communist viewpoints? Will Alaska Story, Watchmen, and other conservative media be suppressed? Section 31 is the kill shot. It makes it a quote-unquote shall for the legislature to, quote, enact sanctions and procedures to dissolve those corporations, LLC, and other artificial persons, end quote. Yet, those that stand for our Constitution are made up of Alaskans who then will lose their jobs and income from those sanctions, which will dissolve those jobs. Citizens United was a U.S. Supreme Court ruling under the 14th Amendment, as the gentleman was talking about, falls under that. What this is trying to do is override SCOTUS. As to dark money, you mean the millions that were spent by outside sources to stop the repeal of ranked choice voting? After the sponsor's comment today, he is calling for and hoping for a major change to SCOTUS. That SCOTUS is wrong and be an activist? Oh, really? In this case, there are SCOTUS is spot on. While we are decidedly leftist, state Supreme Court has been wrong so many times to count. If we ever get a change, so many rulings will be up for repeal. All anyone needs to know, even before reading this bill, is whom the sponsor is. One of the worst supporters of socialism, Marxism, communism in the House. One who cannot follow the rules of the House, much less support the constitutional language that supports freedoms that have been in place
for 250 years. Can you please confine your comments to the bill before us, the resolution before us, and let's not make personal attacks? I'm so sorry, sir.
I was very careful on how I worded that. Then look at those who are supporting this bill, who I'm sure will be the House majority, all hardcore supporters of socialism, Marxism, communism. I call on the members of this committee, the minority of this committee, to call for a roll call vote when the chair calls for passage out of committee, so all can see
who those members are. Thank you, Mr. Coons. Our time is up. We'll move on to Sharman Haley in Anchorage.
Thank you for welcoming me to your committee hearing. My name is Sharman Haley. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. As a concerned citizen, I have been lobbying for a decade for a U.S. constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. For the last 4 years, I've been lobbying for legislation updating Alaska's campaign finance law. As you all know, we've had no limits on campaign contributions since the Ninth Circuit Court in 2021 struck down our $500 limit as being unconstitutionally too low. The currently proposed law, House Bill 16, and the corresponding ballot initiative will set the new limit at $2,000 with inflation adjustments every 10 years. The record is clear that Alaskans, 72% of us at least, want strict limits to return electoral power to the people. In lobbying for this bill, the number one counterargument that I have gotten is, if we limit contributions directly to candidates, but don't limit corporate and super PAC contributions and spending, we're just diverting the big money from the front door, the campaigns that are publicly accountable, to the back door, where they are less accountable. This proposed Alaska constitutional amendment goes a long way to closing that back door, and I support it. Thank you for advancing HJR 31 so we can address this issue ASAP. The other comment I would like to make is the Citizens United case was striking down the bipartisan Federal Campaign Act passed by our Congress to apply to federal elections, and it was thoroughly bipartisan. So it had nothing directly to do with state campaigns. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no one else online, we will close testimony on HJR 31. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on HJR 31 for Wednesday, March 25th. 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set HJR 31 aside and take it up at a later date. Oh, and I will just say for the record, there are a number of folks who joined to testify on the first bill that we heard. I initially said, too bad, too sad. However, since three more people have joined, we will, if we have time allowing, go back and reopen public testimony on HJR 43 for the folks who joined later. Representative Mina.
Chair Gray, I would just like to request that LEGO member that you were mentioning for HJR 31 be posted on basis and shared with the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mina. We will do so.
Thank you.
Our final item of business is HJR 41. rescind requests for constitutional conventions sponsored by Representative Shoggy. At this time, I would like to invite Representative Shoggy and his staff, Amanda Nedemo, to the witness table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your opening remarks.
Oh, thank you, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Kopp, members of the committee, for the opportunity to do an introductory hearing for HJR 41 today. I'm going to begin by just providing my sponsor statement, if that's all right. Very good. You know, the U.S. Constitution serves as the anchor to our nation. It encapsulates the foundational rules and values of our nation and provides the necessary stability for effective governance. Yet the stability does not depend on our Constitution remaining static. This reality creates critical tension. While our constitutional structures must provide for order and endurance, they must also adapt to the evolving needs of a changing society. The founding fathers of our nation understood this critical tension, and rather than leave it unresolved, they enshrined a solution directly into our constitutional fabric through Article 5. Article 5 provides a pathway to amend the Constitution through two distinct processes. One, Congress may propose amendments by a vote of two-thirds vote in both the House and the Senate, or Congress must call a convention to propose amendments when two-thirds of state legislatures, 34 states, petition Congress. The second pathway, specifically its procedural posture, is the subject of this joint resolution. The absence of authoritative guidance in Article 5 raises several key questions that have not been answered, such as who sets the agenda and scope of the convention, Congress, the states, or some combination? Can states limit a convention to specific constitutional topics, or does the mere act of calling a convention open the doors to a process unbounded by subject matter constraints? Neither Congress nor the courts have addressed these issues despite decades of proposals. This creates significant possibility of a runaway convention, a convention unconstrained by procedural safeguards or predictable limits. Without clarity on this issue, states cannot appropriately protect and promote their interests, and many of the values Alaskans hold dear or may hold dear, including free speech, religious freedoms, Second Amendment rights, and privacy protections, could be at risk. What this joint resolution ultimately serves to do is recall our prior petitions to Congress for a constitutional convention as requested by the states, recognizing again that there is significant risk in calling for a convention that does not have those proper safeguards or a clear procedural process in ensuring that any convention is not open-ended and unbounded. With that, I'll look to the chair for guidance on how he'd like us to proceed.
Thank you. Ms. Ndemo, do you want to walk us through the sectional?
Yes. Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Gray. HJR 41.
Sorry. Did you state your name for the record?
She did.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't hear it.
For the record, my name is Amanda Ndemo. I am a staffer to Representative Shoggy. I'll go through the sectional analysis for HJR 41. The preamble acknowledges the historical context that the legislature has, in the past, requested Congress call one or more constitutional conventions to propose amendments. The rescission clause, the rescission clause, which is page... the legislature requests that all previous passed resolutions and enactments petitioning Congress for an Article 5 convention be abrogated upon passage of this resolution. Publication and tallying directs this request to be published in the Congressional Record and account for Alaska's rescission in the official tally of applications. And the distribution of copies clause requires copies of past resolutions to be sent to specific federal officials for notice of the formal rescission.
And Representative Shoggy, for the record, sorry for the awkwardness. It is a little strange sometimes with the resolutions because there really is not sections, but rather just a few be it resolved and whereas is clauses. But I hope members were able to follow along okay there.
Thank you. That was not awkward. And okay, we were good. Able to follow along.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Kopp.
Yeah. Question just for the bill sponsor. Representative Shoggy, what is your sense of undoing prior messages that previous legislative bodies have sent to the congressional delegation asking for such a convention. Like, I'm just thinking of those people being our forebears, and then the youngsters come along and say, we're rescinding all that. Is there principally new arguments or ideas here that weren't considered then? Just kind of walk me through that a little bit, and you know, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Kopp, Representative Shragi, for the record, through the chair. Yeah, this resolution, joint resolution, takes no position on prior resolutions from the state legislature on any number of the issues that we've sent requests in before on. What we've seen through the research that we've done is that the nation at times has had you know, motivation to weigh in on various issues, and you've seen kind of a groundswell across states. For example, through our research, there's been resolutions on fiscal responsibility and reducing the national debt. And so you've seen states call for a convention to meet on that topic and try to constrain the government. And then you've seen these efforts kind of die off or lose momentum. Yet the resolutions calling for a convention to address those issues stay on the books indefinitely. And so this is not taking any particular position on any particular request of Congress to call a convention. It simply acknowledges that there is some liability or risk in keeping those on the books indefinitely because there is no clear guidance in Article 5, and those prior requests could be brought up at any time to be used as justification for a convention on any number of topics, including those not constrained to the original request by various state legislatures. Does that answer your question, Vice Chair Kopp?
Yes. So it sounds like, just in a sentence, it's the biggest worry is that there's no expiration date and things may have changed.
That's correct. Through the chair to Vice Chair Kopp, Representative Shragi, for the record. Yes, it's purely a recognition that there's some risk in leaving these on the books indefinitely. I believe it has been some number of years. I'll turn to my staff for specifics since we've sent in a resolution. And this is just simply saying no opinion on prior requests, just we don't want those requests to be unbounded. And this seems like a proper time, as proper a time as any other, to rescind those requests, given that there doesn't seem to be momentum on those specific topics at this time.
Thank you.
Ms. Ndemo, can you tell us when Alaska has passed these resolutions?
Yes, I actually have, through the chair, I do have a document detailing all the resolutions that have been passed. I didn't have time to pass it to the committee. Give me... So our last, let's see. Our last resolution that we passed was HCR 4, and that was in 2016. So, and a lot of the resolutions go back all the way to 1982.
Can you give us a couple ideas on what those resolutions were on, with the indulgence of the chair?
So with the most recent resolution, which is HCR 4, this related to the duties of delegates selected by the legislature to attend a convention. So this one was actually addressing Article 5. And one of the oldest ones, HJR 17, related to an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which would require the total federal appropriations not exceed total estimated federal revenues. So this is one related to fiscal responsibility. Yeah.
Thank you. I just want to say I started researching this today, so this is not very deep, but I did find that this idea that there's no expiration date on this is actually not well established, and that you can't, if one state says we want a balanced budget and this other state says we want to do term limits, those two don't equal. You can't add those together. And so I think I'm wondering how – well, I did ask AI, how likely is it to have a convention of states in the next 3 years? And it said 95% chance that we will not have a convention of the states in the next 3 years, no matter what. So I'm just curious about how pressing of a need it is that we do this right away because of some why are we doing this?
Chair Gray, I'm very glad to hear that AI has reported that there is only a 5% chance of a constitutional convention being called.
A convention of the states.
A convention of the states, excuse me. Yes, correct. Thank you. I'm glad that AI thinks that we only have a 5% chance of that. I think there is some concern that the worst time is after something has already been done. And so we are in times, I would say today, where I think many on the right or on the left would argue that things that we thought were not possible years ago have occurred, and we live in very turbulent times. I think that's true as a nation today, and there have been new legal theories pushed in every direction. I think you all heard some of these theories earlier today in which there have been significant changes on a national level on a whole host of issues. And what we would hate to see is that in an environment where there is very little case law established on Article 5 and how a convention would be called and the standards by which one would be called, I am not sure that it's clear that two different requests by states could not be tallied together towards the threshold of 2/3 of states requesting this gathering. I don't know that it is clear that you cannot combine those subjects towards the total tally for the call. And what you don't want to see is having states have to kind of retroactively or on the fly, if a new effort emerges to try and call a convention of states, you would not want to see the state caught off guard trying to then walk backwards in rescinding a prior call for a convention of states. And so, look, I think that the likelihood is probably not very likely that you would see a convention of states in the next year or 3 years or maybe even five. But having this issue brought to my attention that there is no clear guidance, that this has not been litigated, that there is not a lot of case law on this issue, that the risks there seem significant, even if the probability is low, the downside if one were to be called is potentially significant. And there's just a lot of uncertainty, and I would rather not see us in a position where we enter into that uncertain realm due to a request for a convention of states that could be from either a decade ago or 5 decades ago.
Thank you. Representative Costello?
Oh, thank you. It is an interesting discussion. So this idea of a runaway convention, which is in the backup material and some of the letters in support of this resolution, I have never heard of that actually being possible. Like when you look at the term limits effort that's happening, you have to get 34 states to pass a resolution asking for this specific topic. And so the idea that you could have a runaway convention to me seems like it's people and their opinion. Like even this afternoon at lunch, I was talking to a group of legislators about it, and half the table said, well, no, you absolutely cannot just tally up all of these requests that states have calling for a convention. And then the other half said, well, yes, you can. And so I have never seen any effort that, shows or proves that you can have a runaway convention. In fact, it's my understanding that if a convention were to bring up a topic that was not delineated in the state's resolution passed by their legislature, that you simply it's not even meeting the qualifications of being able to change the Constitution. And then in terms of just the idea that you would rescind all of the previous ones, I think it's a huge hurdle, to change our Constitution, and I think it was intended to be a huge hurdle so that it's not just a year's effort, but sometimes decades long effort that has been fueled by frustrations or perhaps dissatisfaction with certain things, whether it's term limits or balanced budget or whatever it may be. So, while I appreciate where you're coming from, I think it's challenging to, to actually prove that there could be a runaway convention. So I'd like to know, you know, where you're getting your information about that. And then one of the resolutions we passed actually does delineate how Alaska would go about selecting the people that, you know, that would go to a convention. And I think part of the issue, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, it has never happened before. And so everyone's contemplating, well, what would it be like? What would it look like? And I think we have to go back to our founding documents to get those answers and not just make it up, you know, like we did at lunch or wherever, about an opinion about whether or not it's a risk of a runaway convention. Because if that risk were real, that's a significant risk. And I think we all recognize that. But the effort that it takes and for legislatures to pass these resolutions, topic specific, I think has in itself answered, you know, the question. I don't think that other states that have passed a term limit resolution would be happy if there was a convention, which, by the way, a part of the reason that you do that is so that Congress can see states passing these resolutions and then take it upon themselves, because they don't necessarily want one either. If you understand what's happening, it's kind of, you know, push and pull. But anyway, I think some of that would be interesting for us to get experts to answer those questions.
Thank you. And that's perfect, because we do have experts online for invited testimony.
Yes.
So would you want to go to invited testimony?
Yes, I'd love to go to invited testimony, Chair Gray. And, you know, I just in response to the prior comments to Representative Costello through the chair, I think you make some very good points. I would also argue, because it has not been done and because there is not case law on this, you can't prove it in the inverse either, that you cannot combine requests from states. And there, you talk about the high barrier to be able to call a convention of states. And I think that high barrier exists because there is, in fact, great risk in calling a convention of states and not having clear standards on how that could be done. Finally, before we go to invited testimony, the one other thing I'd like to just highlight is that there is another process for amending the Constitution, which is that Congress, by a two-thirds vote, proposes an amendment to the Constitution. And that is a much clearer, more straightforward and bounded way to be able to address revisions of the Constitution, in my view, than the much riskier and less defined path of a convention of states. And that's part of why we've brought this forward. But if we may now go to invited testimony, I'd be grateful, Chair Gray.
Thank you. Our first invited testifier is David Super, the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Law and Economics at the Georgetown University Law Center, whose scholarship focuses on administrative law, constitutional law, legislation, and the federal budget. Professor Super, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Cobb, and representatives for inviting me to testify. This is a time in our country of great division. I think Alaska's done better than most states in working together and finding ways of problem solving. But as a nation, we are badly split. This is not the time for us to open up the Constitution that has defined us as a country for over two centuries. If we were going to do something like this, we should do it at a time when we believed in trust and compromise, which is not in the air today, unfortunately. A constitution that is opened up at a convention could take away many of the things that are most valuable to us and could fall within the power of whatever interest groups get control of delegation. You've just had a discussion about whether there could be a runaway convention. I would simply say there's no authority to stop a convention from covering anything at once. There's nothing in Article 5 that either limits the purpose of a convention or empowers anybody to do it. And there's no body out there that has the authority to rein in a convention. Congress has no authority once a convention is called. The states have no authority once a convention is called. The Supreme Court has held repeatedly that the process of amending the Constitution is a political question. Even if there were rules that limited a convention to the topics in state resolutions, there's no one to enforce that. And I would note that some of the people pushing hardest for a convention basically are implicitly admitting that it would not be limited. One of the groups that has pushed for this is the so-called Convention of States Project. They had a model convention in Williamsburg a few years ago that was supposedly limited to reining in the powers of the federal government, fiscal responsibility, and term limits, and they proposed capping the number of justices on the Supreme Court, which is none of those things. And this week they suggested putting in federalized control of elections in an amendment that would come out of a convention. That's the reverse of reining in federal powers. And again, the fact that they're saying the convention they propose could do that shows that they recognize that this convention would not be limited. Some people are asking for a convention on both the left and the right because they believe people are not following our current constitution. Anyone who's not inclined to follow the current constitution is not going to be inclined to follow one that is proposed by a convention. As to whether one is likely, I would note that the chairman of the U.S. House Budget Committee, Representative Jody Arrington, has introduced House Con Res 15, in which he suggests, it's a very strangely worded resolution, suggests that we have reached the criteria of 34 states. He does that by combining resolutions that have nothing to do with one another and are passed at very different times. And he also suggests that ratification would be by referendum, whereas Article 5 says that it would be by state conventions or state legislatures. So the rules, such as they are, don't seem to be getting taken seriously, and there's a major push to have a convention happen right now. Before we open up our Constitution at a time of such great turmoil, I would encourage us to think very carefully and not count on supposed limits on a convention that are simply made up by proponents and have no source in law. Thank you very much again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Super. If it's okay with the sponsor, I'll go ahead and go to the next invited testifier, and then we can ask questions of both. So I'll go to Anne Brown. Miss Anne Brown, if you can state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Anne Brown, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a retired attorney, and I am a former chair of the Alaska Republican Party.
Thank you. You can begin your testimony.
Thank you. As I said, my name is Anne Brown. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and by way of a brief introduction, I'm a retired lawyer, and I spent over 20 years working in Alaska Republican Party politics. I've held nearly every party position, from district chair, women's club president, regional chair, vice chair, finally to party chairman. I was glad to see that Representative Schrage has proposed a joint resolution to rescind Alaska's past applications for a constitutional convention or a con-con in common parlance. There's more than one path to amend the U.S. Constitution, but the con-con is the path most fraught with peril for conservatives. This peril has been acknowledged by no less than Supreme Court Justice and Republican Warren Burger in a letter to fellow Republican conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly. Justice Burger wrote, "There is no way to effectively limit or muzzle the actions of a constitutional convention. The convention could make its own rules and set its own agenda. Congress might try to limit the convention to one amendment or one issue, but there is no way to assure that the convention would obey." Decades later, conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia also warned of the dangers of a constitutional convention. He stated, quote, "I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. Whoa, who knows what would come out of it," end of quote. Well, here are a few things that could come out of it. An amendment creating a permanent set-aside of Alaska lands to thwart resource development, development with both of our U.S. senators worked so hard to promote. An amendment creating a constitutional right for non-citizen residents to vote in national elections. an amendment abolishing the Electoral College, an amendment creating the constitutional right to a basic universal income, an amendment providing the constitutional right to an abortion on demand, an amendment making transgender medical procedures legal for children in spite of parental opposition, and any other amendments enshrining progressive social, environmental, and economic policies which conservatives would find abhorrent. Or, as Justice Scalia exclaimed, whoa, who knows what would come out of it? Consequently, I encourage my fellow Republicans in the legislature to support this joint resolution for rescission of past requests for a CONCON. Alaska should not be on the record requesting a CONCON that would open Pandora's box to a parade of progressive horribles. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Are there any questions for our two invited testifiers? I'll start. First to Mr. Super, you mentioned that now is not a good time to do a constitutional convention because it's not a time of trust and compromise. Can you please let us know what previous points in American history were good times of trust and compromise where a constitutional convention would have been a better time to do it?
As other witness and the representative indicated, I generally think the safest way to amend the Constitution is with specific amendments proposed by Congress that we can all decide whether they're good things or bad things rather than an open-ended convention. But if we were to do something of this kind, the period immediately following World War II, I think, was a period when the country was looking to move forward and there was a lot of effort to seek consensus. An effort was not made then, I think, because there wasn't seen the sufficient need. But that's a time when you might have imagined consensus amendments. Now you'll get, if the liberals control the convention, you'll get the kinds of amendments that the other witness mentioned. If conservatives control it, you'll get the flip. What you won't get now is consensus amendments.
Thank you. To Ms. Brown, you mentioned that, I think you quoted a Supreme Court justice as saying that there was nothing to enforce that delegates didn't stray to another topic. In my research, it was suggested that state legislatures could make it a crime for a delegate from their state to stray off the topic that they are there for. If Alaska made it a crime for Alaska delegates to stray, and if they did, for example, where they were supposed to talk about a balanced budget and they started talking about term limits, would be immediately arrested. Would that be a way to ensure that we stay on topic?
Well, I think, let me say, Representative, as a lawyer, I can tell you that legislatures can pass all kinds of laws and those laws can be overturned by courts. And I don't pretend to be the expert that our other witnesses on the Constitution. However, anything that happens that one partisan side or the other doesn't like is going to be a court case. And this is going to drag out and waste time and money and effort and emotion. And so I'm not sure that what you're saying is actually so airtight and solid, with all due respect.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Follow-up question for you, Ms. Brown. You talked about all these possible amendments that could come out of the Constitutional Convention. Wouldn't it be true that any amendments that came out of that convention would then have to be ratified by 3/4 of the states, which would be a higher bar? Would you see that you know, these amendments that you were talking about that you found objectionable would be easily immediately ratified by 3/4 of the states?
Well, I think I would. I don't want to dodge your question, answering your question, but what I would say is that the professor told us that amending the Constitution such that a particular proposed amendment must be passed by 2/3 of both houses of Congress and then ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the state is safer. And it is much safer because the particular subject of the amendment is what is before the bodies looking at it. And so anytime you have a convention where you're getting a slew of, you know, amendments proposed, I think you're looking at sort of a mess. The other thing I would mention, if I could, is that among the amendments adopted in the 20th century are those, and the Constitution was amended in the 20th century, and those gave women the right to vote, enacted and then repealed prohibition, abolished poll taxes, and lowered the minimum voting age from 21 to 18. So it is possible to amend the Constitution, have solid amendments come out that are passed by two-thirds of both houses of Congress, and then ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states. And it can be done in a calm environment with due consideration for particular issues. And that, I think, is the way to go here if amendments are requested.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. I will, from your answer, I'll refer back to Mr. Super for one more question from me for him. And that is based on, you know, Ms. Brown talked about the traditional method of Congress proposing amendments. Mr. Super, do you believe that Congress currently today is doing a good job of amending the Constitution as needed? And, you know, there's no need to work around. We've got a great Congress working together to amend the Constitution as needed.
We have a very divided Congress, as we have a very divided country. And we don't have a Congress that is seeking consensus, but there's no reason to believe that a convention would be any better. Indeed, it would be likely subject to enormous influence from special interests. And with regard to the question, the comment the other witness made about ratification, I would just add that at least six of the amendments that we've already had to the Constitution wrap together multiple different provisions. By my count, there are eight different things in the 14th Amendment. So you could imagine taking something that would repeal the Second Amendment, a liberal priority, and packaging that with a conservative priority and seeing whether the package could get amended or not. All of the amendments that the other witness mentioned would be dead on arrival in our Constitution, as well as amendments that are special interest appeals on the other side of the spectrum. Our Congress is not reaching consensus about amendments to the Constitution because I think we're too divided to have a consensus as a country, and we shouldn't be trying to amend the Constitution on the fly with one group or another making a power play.
Mr. Super, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the framers of the Constitution, when they proposed this aspect of Article 5, were afraid that there might come a day where Congress is so divided and so uncooperative that this would be a way for the people to have a voice when Congress is no longer a voice for them. And I just do not see a time where Congress will do an amendment to do a balanced budget or to limit their own terms, because it would be a limit of their own power. And so I could see how an Article 5 constitutional convention would be the only way that we're able to achieve those types of amendments. But you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, one of the very most important of our founders was James Madison, who wrote much of the structure of our Constitution. When it was suggested in the first Congress that we convene another convention to write a Bill of Rights, he led the charge against that, having seen just how out of control a convention could get. So I think the thought was that that this would be something that would happen if there's a broad consensus among the public that Congress was disagreeing with. But there is no broad consensus among the public for any amendments that I'm aware of. And should such a consensus arise, I have no doubt that Congress is perfectly capable of writing something. With regards to term limits, The term limits for the president were written to not affect the current occupant of the office. You could imagine Congress putting in term limits that wouldn't affect any sitting members. So I don't think it's a non-starter. There are arguments for and against term limits, but there's no indication that I've seen that our Congress is particularly out of step on these issues with the vast majority of the American public.
Thank you. Good job. If I will just say, for situational awareness, we do have a number of public testifiers for this bill, but I asked a lot of questions. Is there anyone else who has questions for our invited testimony? Seeing none, thank you both for your testimony. We will now open the floor for public testimony on HJR 41. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony. And because we have a number, I will be timing, so we have a 3-minute time limit.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Bizzard. I'm the current legislative liaison for the Convention of States. And for clarity's sake, the Convention of the States project is not a constitutional convention. I'd like to clarify that. For the record, they are two completely different animals, and in no way would a Convention of the States be able to open up the Constitution to be changed. All we can do is amend it. And in a Convention of States, when it's specifically called, the resolution will be the guidelines or the guideline for what is to come out of the convention. And in this particular case, the resolution that was passed back in 2014 calling for three areas, fiscal budget, a balanced budget at the federal government level, term limits for Supreme Court, senators, and representatives, and third, to address federal overreach. And that's what would come out of the convention. Is it going to be wild and chaotic? We don't know. But we have a precedence for conventions. Before we became a country, we were colonies. And the colonies had problems. And the colonies would call a convention. And the members of the colonies, they would send their best people or their people with guidelines on what's to be discussed and what's to come out of it. And it happened many, many, many times. It eventually did grow to us having our first constitutional convention, which created our current constitution. I realize I'm limited by time here, so I'd like to quickly just go over some other notes. Congressional Research Service number 42589 report has some useful arguments. It says that the founders created the convention method as a way around Congress. This certifies that Congress does not control the convention, as some of our opponents say. By supporting a convention, we are simply using the tool the framers gave us to bypass federal deadlock. And at this point, I'd like to mention that out of the 27 amendments that we have, if you think about it, we had an amendment about once every 9 years or so until about 50 years ago, and we've had no amendments. And as has been addressed earlier, not too many of the people on the Hill are going to actually vote themselves out of office by suggesting a constitutional amendment to limit their terms. The report does a great job explaining how hard it is for any amendment to actually pass. Even if a convention proposes something, it still needs 3/4 of the states, that would be 38, to ratify it. And as the Second Amendment has been brought up, and I am a big proponent of the Second Amendment, are you really going to muster 38 states to repeal the Second Amendment? Not going to happen. So if by some strange set of circumstances, I apologize, I'm a little uneasy here doing this. I'm calming myself down.
And your time is up, so you'll need to wrap it up.
We are not in favor of this resolution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Mike Cochran. I live in Juneau, and I do support keeping. I would not vote for this, and I'll tell you why. Shortly after Tom called me, Celia Ella Fritz from Kenai had 1,765 people who would not vote for this. And truthfully, I agree with what the conventionofstates.com proposes to change is not anything radical. The term limits for Congress need to be adjusted. And I'll just say that I have no idea when we have had people in Congress for 50 years. Apparently, we do have senators in Congress for 50 years. We had a representative of Alaska, unfortunately, after he made a deal of $5.1 trillion with another guy who was of the opposite party. He died on a plane the way back. Now, and this is what I can say is that to restrict the term limits of Congress would be good, not just for me, but for my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and everyone in America. We have never had a time when people can be in Congress for this length of time. And I would have to say that I am happy to be an American, and that is such a valuable that I can speak on this. And that's all I can say. I love being an American.
Thank you for your testimony.
Is that it?
We'll now go online. We have David Clark. If you'll take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Daniel Clark?
Oh, sorry. Daniel Clark.
Thank you. I stand in strong opposition to HHGR 41. I can't see the point of throwing away the work that's already been done. And all the scare tactics that have been going on about convention, anything that would be proposed or passed out of the convention would still have to go through the process of being the states would have to still buy into it. It's not a done deal. So I strongly suggest that we keep going with it. I hope they get more signatures in other states. I believe the convention is a good idea to protect things that we need protected that would be kind of iffy, like 2A. I'm also want the federal government to live within its bounds. Its overreach is getting to be a serious problem. It's interfering in states, the people. It's just interfering with the people. I mean, most people, you should not hear from the federal government, but most of us hear from them quite often now. So I'd like to leave us with Thomas Jefferson, will be directed from Washington when to sow, when to reap, we should seem to want bread. So I stand in strong opposition to this bill, and anything that comes out of it out of the convention would still have to be ratified. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Michael Ferris. Please take yourself off mute and begin your testimony.
My name is Michael Ferris. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify. I'm an attorney and the co-founder of the Convention of the States Project. I also have taught constitutional law at Patrick Henry College for 17 years. I've litigated constitutional cases in the Supreme Court of the United States. And importantly, I've litigated successfully two cases about the Article 5 process of amending the Constitution. I represented state legislators in the late 1970s into the early 80s in the case over the Equal Rights Amendment in the process of the ratification where Congress tried to change the rules for ratification in the middle of the stream. And then Last year in 2025, I represented Kansas state legislators to challenge the constitutionality of a provision of the Kansas Constitution that sought to control the process of amending the U.S. Constitution. I won that case as well this last November. The theme of the testimony you've heard today from the experts is that we don't know what the outcome would be because we don't know the rules of because there's nothing explicit in Article 5 of the Constitution to give us all the rules. Just because things in the Constitution are not explicit doesn't mean that there aren't rules. For example, the right to trial by jury is explicitly in the Constitution, but nothing in the text of any of the provisions of the Bill of Rights specifies that a jury has to find you guilty by unanimous vote. Because that idea of unanimous vote is a principle of due process that's encapsulated in the larger principle. So we know the big rules are in the Constitution. Trials have to follow due process. The detailed rules are found in historical precedent. And that's true about Article 5 as well. The idea that you can combine the various resolutions and not go by a rule of germaneness is just simply not accurate. There have been 450 applications for convention from 49 different states. There are more than enough applications from more than 34 states currently pending that would be sufficient to call a convention, but we haven't called one because you have to have agreement on the topics. That is the historically established precedent. Now, has there been litigation on it? No, because nobody said anything to the contrary that would give you the standing to file a lawsuit to challenge it. But not all precedent is judicial. Some is, and some are historically created precedent by acts of Congress. And the failure of Congress to call a convention by jumbling things together, no matter what one congressman says in a bill introduction, the historical practice stands on a sale. You cannot combine those. They have to be on the same topic. And when 34 states agree on the topic, how is the topic set? The answer is 34 states agree to it by passing resolutions on the same topic. And then can you change the rules in the middle of the stream? Well, the case I litigated on the ERA answers that question. You can't change the rules in the middle of the stream.
Mr. Ferris, I need you to wrap up your testimony.
Yes. Okay. The rules are clear, and I would encourage any members having questions. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have. I have litigated this area more than probably almost any other lawyer in the country.
Thank you. I think going by time, we'll now hop over to the Soldotna LIO. It looks like there was – or the Kenai LIO. There's people who've been waiting a long time. Joan Kaur.
Mr. Chairman, if you could have Mr. Ferris send us in his written testimony, I think that would be helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Ferris, did you hear that? If you could please send us an email with the written testimony. What's our email address? House.judiciary@aklag.gov. Ms. Kaur, please state.
I'm Joan Kaur.
Thank you.
I'm Soldotna, and I'm asking you to oppose HJR 41. And we need to keep our call for a Constitution, Convention of States. This is a nonpartisan effort. It's not a convention to rewrite our Constitution. The only three subjects that I was told would be discussed and possible amendments to our Constitution made is the three. One is to discuss the term limits, like what has been mentioned. Our system of government was not designed for lifetime politicians. It was designed for statesmen, for working people who would do their duty to help their country and get back home. This is the only way we're going to get term limits, because Congress won't pass this. The second issue I was told was going to be discussed at this convention is fiscal responsibility, like a balanced budget, which has been mentioned. We the people are expected to live within our means, and we expect Congress to do the same thing. It's obvious they think it's okay to flagrantly spend other people's money. And the third issue is government overreach. Government needs to stay in their lane instead of encroaching into every area of our lives, from family to churches, and to regulations without public input, which is tyranny. We need this convention of states. So many of our congressmen are not listening to it. They do not want term limits. They don't want to curb spending. They don't want to stop government overreach. And this is our only recourse as the public. So please oppose HGR 41. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Tom Kaur at the Kenai LIO.
Hello, I'm Tom Kaur. Have you opposed HJR 41? We need a constitutional convention. It's the only way we're going to get term limits and get government spending in line. If I spent like the government, I'd be in jail forever. And yet it's government standard procedure. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we'll finish off at the Kenai LIO with Patricia Boutin.
Hi, my name is Patricia Boutin. I live in Soldotna. Committee members, I oppose HJR 41. Rescinding our existing application would be a grave mistake, effectively silencing people's voice for federal reform, including fiscal restraints and term limits. Article 5 is not a constitution convention. It is the solution to an overreaching government. Article 5 gives us, we the people, a tool the founders intended for us to use to fix the mess in D.C. America is not a democracy. We are a republic. Please stand with Alaskans. Please stand with Alaskans who want to rein in federal overreach by voting no on HJR 41 and preserving our state's application. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Boutin. And we'll now go to Jack Shockley in Anchorage.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jack Shockley, and I'm not a lawyer, but I do agree with all the testimony you've heard about the frustration with our government. And we feel that I am totally against HJR 41. It's the only recourse that I see of bringing in our government. We cannot ask the Senate or the Congress to give themselves term on it because they won't do it. So this is our only recourse. You see it, we see it. So
thank you for your testimony.
Please vote against it.
We'll now go to Mike Coons in Wasilla. Please take yourself off mute, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Coons, and I definitely oppose HJR 41. I am the author of the Constitution, the Countermand Amendment, and the Delegate Resolution, both of which passed in 2016. I was a co-author with Charles Kaplowitz. I worked with then Representative Shelley Hughes and at the time Senator, I'm trying to remember my senator at the time. It took us 2 years to get that thing passed. We went through a lot of committee hearings. We had a lot going on about it, and we got it passed. And we got it passed by a strong majority. The balanced budget amendment is being, and the countermand amendment, which we passed here, which now are being called government overreach, as well as term limits, are very close to occurring, especially balanced budget amendment. There's a lot of talk about if we have met the threshold and Congress just doesn't want to admit it. The delegate resolution would stop a lot of this con garbage. The delegate resolution that we designed and we put forward to the state of Alaska and got passed was very specific on how what was going to happen at the convention, and that it was the state legislatures that would approve or disapprove if they wanted to do multis. The delegates, it was very clear what the delegates could do and could not do, and if they didn't, the state legislature could pull them back. So there was a lot of work that went into that, and the Convention of States actually went along with it after a period of years. The Convention of States put forward a trial convention. As a matter of fact, at that trial convention, the balanced budget amendment failed. The countermand amendment passed. There was one small amendment to it. But other than that, that passed by a wide margin. Shelley Hughes, Kathy Tilton was there, both representing the state of Alaska. The members of that convention were all state legislators. So there is a strong a lot of work has been going into this, and the lies that we were hearing, and I'm going to just flat out call them that, the lies that the two quote-unquote expert testifiers put forward were just that. And we know what's we worked hard on this. I worked hard on this. And if you guys want to ask any questions, I would gladly answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Elizabeth Chase and Kasiloff.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Chase, and I am a retired school bus driver, stay-at-home mom here in Kasiloff, and I signed the Convention of States petition and then became a volunteer for the Convention of States because two-thirds of the people in Alaska want to see term limits and fiscal responsibility and to stop government overreach, to let us do our jobs here. So I said all that to say I oppose this bill, and I believe the person that brought the bill forward didn't do his research because we are very limited at what we can be doing at the convention, or we don't get to go. But remember this, two-thirds of the people who hear this, Democrat and Republican, want this. They want to balance the budget. They want term limits for our Congress. You know, it's our only way, and I just am thankful for our founding fathers that put Article 5 in our Constitution to give the people a voice when they are not doing their job. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Donald Brand in Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Brand, and I'm currently from Palmer. I was the legislative liaison during the original hearings and discussions relating to the passage of the Convention of States resolution, with the able help of a number of people, but notably Tom Bizzard and Representative Tammy Wilson. Obviously, I'm strongly in favor of the original resolution, and I am opposed to HJR 41. It's been fascinating listening to the testimony to date on this subject. It's just rehashing all the things that we did back in 2013. And it's the same arguments, and it's some of the same answers. And I think that the right answers have been clearly stated by Tom, by Michael, and some of the other testifiers. So I was a strong supporter back then. I'm even a stronger supporter now. This whole notion of a divided country, that means we just need this even more than we did before we wind up in the ditches. Okay, so please stand with the Alaskans who want to rein in the federal overreach. Congress will never do it to themselves. And please vote no on HJR 41 and preserving our state's application. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Lauren Baxter in Anchorage.
Hi, Lauren Baxter. I'm from Anchorage, and thank you for taking my testimony. You know, one of the things, I oppose HJR 41, and the Convention of States would help restore federalism and state sovereignty. Article 5 gives the states a constitutional path to propose amendments, you know, to stop government overreach, to limit federal powers to the enumerated powers in the Constitution. And unfortunately, our
our Congress has overstepped those powers in many areas. And basically, it returned decision-making authority to the states on issues like education, health care, and other regulations that our founding fathers had originally planned to be with the, be decided at the state level. And then regarding, fiscal constraints, you know, it's frustrating. We're approaching $40 trillion, and it seems like Congress has no appetite whatever to stop. So this would, again, as has been mentioned before, provide a balanced budget amendment. Also, it's also been iterated by several other people. It would limit, and we're looking at term limits to try to actually get Congress to confine we don't need lifetime representatives in Congress, and they're never going to vote themselves out of office or limit their own terms. So I think this is the best way possible. Also, as brought up before, it has to take 38 states. Once we go through the Constitutional Convention and through the Convention of States to actually implement it. And regarding a comment made, I think, in the opening, it said that there really wasn't an interest for this right now. I'd like to point out that Kansas just recently passed the Convention of States, so there is an interest. And with that, I concluded my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Our final testimony will be from former Alaska State House Judiciary Committee member Ben Carpenter of Nikiski. He's unavailable. That could. Is it? Are you there? Is it? I mean, are you muted, Mr. Carpenter?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hey, good afternoon, former colleagues. Having a little technical difficulty there. Chair Gray, you hit the nail on the head with your question, why are we doing this? HGR 41 is silent on why it is necessary. It simply recognizes that Alaskans have asked Congress to convene an Article 5 constitutional convention, a process that will take years to accomplish, and rescinds this request before the process is complete. This means Alaskans will find no verbiage, no argument, no context in the text of the resolution that expresses their opinion. The legislation passed by our past legislature laid out the reasoning and expressed the will of the people in requesting Congress to act on an Article 5 Constitution. This resolution does not speak for Alaskans as drafted. Many Alaskans are concerned about the direction of our federal government. There's no secret as to what topics are being discussed nationally to address during an Article 5 convention, two of which have broad support among the Alaskans I have spoken to, which is addressing our unsustainable spending with a balanced budget amendment, a concept that the state of Alaska benefits from and which the United States of America would benefit from as well. The second topic many Alaskans would like to see is an end to the lifetime membership in Congress by implementation of term limits. Arguments against an Article 5 convention largely rely upon fear of what could happen when leaders of our nation gather to address a mid-course correction on this experiment in self-government. The question we should be asking is, what is the alternative? If our nation is so divided that we cannot address the largest problems facing us in a convention, what is the peaceful alternative? Alaskans should be aware that Ann Brown is a patriotic American, but she is wrong, and she no longer speaks on behalf of Republicans in the state of Alaska. Congress will never pass a balanced budget amendment or limit their terms of office on their own. Only the people, through an Article 5 convention, will accomplish these vital tasks. It speaks volumes that Ann was invited to testify on this resolution sponsored by a progressive Anchorage independent. Clearly, there are members of our society who want to continue the status quo right off the fiscal cliff. In closing, I wish to encourage the leaders of our state and our nation. We will get nothing positive done if we rely upon fear as our guide. Please oppose HGR 41 and allow the Article 5 process to continue to proceed with Alaskan support, as Alaskans have previously communicated to the rest of the nation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no one else in the room or online waiting to testify, public testimony on HJR 41 is now closed. I would now like to set an amendment deadline on HJR 41 for Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set HJR 41. Oh, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, this is just for the bill sponsor. I would love that list of all of the resolutions that have been passed by the legislature. I know we've been talking a lot about HJR 22 that was passed in 2014, but I know there are other ones out there. So I would just love that list so we know exactly what we're repealing. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now set HJR 41 aside and bring it up at a later date. I am going to go back, in case anyone stayed online this whole time, for our very first bill, which was HJR 31. HJR 43. We're going back to HJR 43, voter privacy. And if Landa Bailey in Homer is still online, please take yourself off mute and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gray and committee members. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
Great. For the record, my name is Landa Bailey. I'm a resident of Alaska living in Homer. I was born in Alaska, attended K through 12 in Alaska public schools, attended the University of Alaska Southeast, and retired from State of Alaska employment. I fully support passage of HJR 43 and urge you to also pass legislation to statutorily protect Alaska's constitutional voting rights. You may not be able to prevent risks of personal identity theft resulting from the released voter registration files by the Lieutenant Governor, but you can statutorily protect our voting rights, Alaska's state's rights, and prevent federal overreach by adopting legislation before the end of this legislative session prohibiting DOJ's recommended purging of registered Alaskan voters who registered under penalty of felony criminal prosecution for illegally registering. Legislation should statutorily require adequate and timely notice to the registered voter the DOJ wants removed, require production by DOJ of credible proof of the registered voter's illegality or fraud as it relates to registration, and set out specific timelines to allow the registered voter time to overcome such a potential purge before an election. These and other Alaska statutory protections may very well safeguard many Alaskans' right to vote. I concur with the testimony of former Attorney General Bruce Vitello and Attorney Bacalar, and am more than alarmed after reading Legislative Counsel Dunmire's legal memo in which he says the Division of Elections has rung a bell that cannot be unrung. As a member of the Alaska Bar Association, I'm guessing the legal memorandums written by attorneys who swore an oath to protect Alaska's constitution to advise the State of Alaska Division of Elections before the delivery of Alaska voters to the DOJ discuss Alaska's constitutional rights of privacy, and they also discuss safeguards to protect the personal information contained in those released records. And I hope that you do get those legal memorandums. In addition to personal confidential information concerns, there are many other questions, including the following. Will a registered voter in Alaska be informed before the election if the DOJ wants their name removed from the voter registration? Will that registered voter have time to overcome the required purge? Will the Division of Elections require adequate and credible proof from the DOJ to warrant removing a registered voter? And is the Division of Elections required to provide the registered voter that proof? If so, what are the types of adequate and credible proof? Will Alaskan registered voters find out just before they are ready to vote at the on the ballot on the day of election, or when they don't receive their requested absentee ballot? If notified before an election, will registered voters have time to obtain required government documents and avoid or overcome removal before the end of the voter registration deadline? In addition to the discussion in HJR 43 of ensuring Alaskans don't lose their bedrock right to vote, specifically in lines 12 through 25 on page 4, I urge you to consider language to protect women. Consider that an Alaska woman born, adopted, married, divorced, remarried, widowed, and remarried, all occurring in Alaska, all involve different last names and various types of Alaska vital records. According to a simple Google search, it takes the state of Alaska 6 to 9 weeks to issue related certificates at considerable cost. Alaska women who are registered to vote under penalty of criminal charges now face not only potential risks of identity theft, but also the possibility they can't timely overcome their purge, even if they are informed of the purge, by obtaining the various Alaska vital records documents because of financial inability, time constraints, and voter registration deadlines. If they aren't provided adequate and credible evidence, these women won't know how to defend their right to vote. Government-issued identification showing U.S. citizenship is typically a passport or a birth certificate with no name changes. Will the DOJ require Alaska Division of Elections to purge all voters who are registered to vote but who cannot prove U.S. citizenship without a passport or a birth certificate with no name changes? Registered voters in Alaska face very real threats to our rights to vote and monumental privacy protection decisions. We can change our passwords and financial account numbers, but cannot ever change our dates of birth. Changes to government-issued passports, Social Security, driver's license, and voter registration numbers require considerable time, extensive paperwork, huge financial costs, and some changes require legal expenses. Banks and other financial institutions use private information for proof of ID. No state official, including any of you, know who now has access to our registered voters' information contained in our voter registration rolls. Please pass HJR 43 with protection for women, and also think about statutory protections to ensure that Alaska women who are registered to vote in Alaska can vote in the upcoming election. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. It looks like Bill Witt and William Hearn are no longer available. Is that correct?
Correct, sir.
Okay. Then it looks like we have no further testimony on HJR 43. So HJR 43 public testimony is again closed. Before we adjourn, I would like to set an amendment deadline on House Bill 74, Crime Counterfeit Non-Functioning Airbag, for Wednesday, March 25th, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. Please work with my committee to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. That concludes today's business before the House Judiciary Committee. Before we adjourn, here is a preview of our next meeting. This Friday, HGR 23, Constitutional Amendment, Governor's Proposed Budget by Representative Underwood, and House Bill 367, Consumer Data Privacy Act by Representative Story. The time is now 3:12 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.